This week, Raw gets funky. WrestleMania may not, in fact, be coming back to Madison Square Garden. Shaq to WWE, is it a done deal? And the new network gets a new launch date. Would somebody please call my mama?
I am the Sama Monster.
Welcome to the Sala Monster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com. It is episode 201 for Sunday, January 15th, 2012. I am the Sala Monster. Thank you for all the great feedback to episode 200 last week, the big landmark show. Got a lot of good feedback from you guys. You all seem to enjoy it. Hopefully, we have another 200 episodes and more yet to come here with the Sound Off. So again, I just wanted to say thank you for that. Got a lot to cover this week. It just seems every week there's a new polarizing segment on Raw, either with a new debut or a return or, you know, whatever the case may be, and you either really, really love it or you really, really hate it. And I think you can pretty much figure out which segment I'm talking about this week. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more, but got something to get to first. I got something to get off my chest here at the beginning of the show, a little segment I'm going to call This Week's Rant, and it concerns the PG direction of WWE. Now, on Facebook this week, I posted a message saying that I find it amusing. Some people still blame all of WWE's problems on that little black box in the upper left-hand corner that reads TVPG. And you know full well that these same people would still be complaining if they replaced that box with TV14. And this whole thing was inspired by a thread that was actually on the SE Scoops fan page on Facebook about this week's Raw ratings and what WWE should do or could do to reverse the trend of declining viewership in hour number two. This is becoming a very big problem now. With a couple of exceptions, for many, many weeks now, the pattern seems to be that Raw starts somewhat strong, and ultimately their viewership dips in hour number two. So, SE Scoops posed the question on their Facebook page, and some of the responses were amazing. Of course, it's not just that one thread. I mean, I get emails all the time about dropping PG and reverting back to the Attitude Era. When is the Attitude Era going to come back? People ask all the time. The answer is, it's not. But these people swear on a stack of Bibles that by simply reverting back to the swearing and the sex and the hardcore matches and the blood and bashing people's brains in with steel chairs, they swear that then and only then will WWE have a reversal of fortune. Because that's worked out so well for TNA, as we can all see. Of course, this is BS. That's a simple way of putting it. It's a fallacy. It's a simple-minded answer to a problem for which there is no simple answer. The problems run much deeper than this. The easiest answer to give is that it's just bad creative. Bad creative. The writers don't know what they're doing. And you know what? That's a very big part of it. It's either bad creative because the writers they've hired have no concept of what pro wrestling is supposed to be, or maybe they do, but their ideas get shuffled to the side by Vince and Stephanie, and they simply get a bad rap. I think it's a combination of both, but creative may not even be the main answer. I'd argue that it's a combination of two other things. Number one, the fact that everything these days is scripted, and no one has the opportunity to really open up and show their true personality. And number two, you know, back during the Monday Night Wars, this glory period that everybody is so desperate to teleport back to, we had talents like Bret Hart, Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, The Rock, Mankind, Undertaker, Chris Jericho, Kurt Angle, Edge and Christian, The Hardys, and countless others, many of whom were in the prime of their careers. It was like a perfect storm. Let's face facts. The talent pool today just isn't as good or as deep as it was back then. And that's not to say that there aren't very talented guys on the roster right now, or that they aren't better athletes in some cases than the guys were back then, but I think it's a sign of the times because many of the guys coming up now are products of the modern-day developmental system, not the OVW system from over a decade ago, and certainly not the territorial system that died out in the early 90s. I mean, I just got done watching the latest Legends Roundtable on WWE Classics, which, by the way, if you have access to it, you got to check it out. It's got Roddy Piper, DDP, Jim Ross, Michael Hayes, Gene Okerlund. It's a great show. And they were just talking about the territories on that program as well. I was watching something else. They were talking about the territories. There's a reason why people always revert back to talking about the old territory system. I'm not saying it was perfect, but there's a reason why it existed for so long in that way. And you cannot deny the talents that were turned out by that system. Men like Steve Austin and Mick Foley and even Chris Jericho, if you read his first book, A Lion's Tale, they came up very differently than the talents of today do. Paying your dues meant something quite a bit different back then. A lot of guys who had no business being in wrestling were weeded out early on. I mean, you could go to Japan or Mexico and cut your teeth over there before coming back here a better performer. Even the Japanese wrestling scene today is just a shell of what it once was. So, does this mean wrestling is screwed and the problems can't be fixed? No, I think the problems can be fixed. You know, wrestling may never again be what it once was, but it can still be successful and it can still be fun to watch. For all the bad things we can complain about, there's a lot of good things as well. I mean, how do you turn Raw's ratings around? Maybe you don't. You know, maybe a 2.9 or a 3.1 is that new threshold. What 4.5 and 5.0 used to be. You know, today you've got a lot more television channels and competition than you did 12 years ago, not to mention the advent of things like DVR and online streaming. Instead of worrying so much about how poorly CM Punk did in that one quarter hour, or how many extra viewers John Cena raked in for the five-minute overrun, maybe WWE ought to focus on giving its fans TV that makes sense and doesn't insult their intelligence. You know, the Funkasaurus doesn't insult my intelligence. In fact, shit like that can be very entertaining. When I was growing up, we had a ton of characters like that on TV. But writing your TV show like it's some D-level horror movie and booking your talents in a way that accentuates their weaknesses, as opposed to focusing on their strengths, either for political purposes or because you're a fucking man-child who gets off on stuff like that, whatever the reason, that's only going to drive viewers away. Booking your lead announcer as a clown who insults and degrades everybody on your show and insults the audience is only going to drive viewers away. So maybe, just maybe, it's time for the man-child to crawl back into his playpen and let the adults take over. Then and only then are we going to start to see some real change. Monday Night Raw, the good, the bad, and the ugly. That was quite the show last Monday in Corpus Christi, wasn't it? We had the horror movie sequel involving Kane, Zack Ryder, and John Cena, now featuring Eve Torres. Chris Jericho came back with the jacket, and once again remained silent, as I predicted he would. And we finally saw the debut of the Funkasaurus, Brodus Clay. Somebody call his mama. Ernest Miller cannot be pleased at how blatantly they are ripping off his gimmick, or maybe he is pleased, I don't know. I mean, maybe he'll see it as some sort of tribute. The crowd sucked for the most part, but I'm not going to jump down their throat the way some of the people online have that I've seen. I mean, can you really blame them? I actually enjoyed this show for the most part, but if I paid money to sit in the crowd and watch a million backstage segments on a giant screen and fights in the parking lot, I'd be kind of quiet too. You know, WWE didn't give them a whole hell of a lot to get excited about, but as a TV show, I was entertained the whole way through. I was certainly never bored watching this show. Sometimes by like the 90-minute mark, I'm dozing off. Not this week. This show kept my attention, and at times it had the feel of an Attitude Era show. I just got done talking about how the Attitude Era will never come back. But there were elements to the show that kind of harkened back. It's kind of hard for me to describe exactly what it was. Maybe it was that opening segment, fighting in the back and all that kind of stuff. It may seem odd that I would like a show like this because a lot of people hated it, and it is kind of odd. You know, perhaps if I had watched this show in a foul mood going into it, I would be less kind. But like I said, I came away from it thinking this was a pretty enjoyable show overall. And I think the reason is because in some ways it felt different. You know, in other ways, we had a lot of the same old shit, but parts of it felt different. That's today's secret word, everybody. I'm stealing a gimmick from the old Pee-wee's Playhouse show. Today's word is different. And different can be good. Speaking of the good, starting out the show with the Kane promo was decidedly not different, but having John Cena come out with a serious look on his face and going right after Kane, that was certainly different, and I liked it. I really liked the opening segment, the brawling through the hallway backstage and, you know, into the parking lot. More action, less talking. Simply put, I liked this opening segment a lot. I also want to restate, after last week's sound-off, that Mark Henry is still my hero. It was very noticeable on this show how toned down Michael Cole was this week on commentary. He sounded like a regular announcer without his over-the-top shtick, and in a kayfabe kind of way, I'd like to think it was because Mark Henry scared him shitless on SmackDown last Friday. So, thank you, Mark Henry. The backstage segment with Miz, Johnny Ace, David Otunga gave us maybe the second best line of the year so far, behind CM Punk's Beat You Like a Bitch line last week. When Miz told Laryngitis that he wanted his own private security force. You see, Miz is still terrified of R-Truth. And Laryngitis told him that he'd have to find his own. He said, "I'm not little Jimmy, I'm big Johnny." And then he turned to David Otunga and he smiled after he said it. I laughed my ass off at that. And I cannot wait for this guy to get the shit kicked out of him. But I'll almost be sad if it means the end of the character. You know, and to think Vince McMahon once decreed that Johnny Ace's character was no longer allowed to speak. He was no longer allowed to have a speaking role on television because of how awful he was. What was he thinking? Is the only thing I could say. This guy I don't want to say he's getting better, but his shtick is not getting old as quickly as I thought it would. If anything, it's kind of growing on me. We got two announcements this week for the WWE Hall of Fame. Ahead of the ticket on sale. Tickets went on sale this weekend, and I think for the most part they're all gone. It's not completely sold out, but all the good seats are pretty much gone. Mil Máscaras was already announced a couple of months ago to the live crowd in Mexico, but it won't be official, I guess, until it's announced on TV. So the first inductee officially announced as the class of 2012 in the WWE Hall of Fame was Edge. Rated R superstar becomes the youngest man ever inducted into the Hall of Fame. He beats out the late Eddie Guerrero, I think only by a couple of months in terms of his age. Edge, of course, was forced to retire. It was spinal stenosis, I believe, was the diagnosis last year after WrestleMania. He may be the only person in WWE history to retire as a world champion, if, in fact, he does not ever again wrestle another match. It would have been more appropriate, I think, for him to be inducted in Toronto, so I took that to be a sign that WrestleMania is headed either to Indianapolis or Dallas perhaps next year. We found out a little bit later on in the week that that may not be the case. I'll get to that in a little bit. Texas would make sense, though, for WrestleMania if they wanted to lure Steve Austin out of retirement for one more match. I'm sure that was a big part of why Mania is in Miami this year with Rock Wrestling. In an interview with, I believe it was Arta Ocal, Edge claimed that he was told it was put to a vote amongst the boys, and they voted unanimously for him to be inducted this year. I do know WWE has solicited feedback from wrestlers before on who they would like to see inducted, but ultimately it's Vince McMahon's decision. I mean, there is no voting process here. Maybe that's what Edge was told, but there is no formal voting process that anybody sticks to. Ultimately, it's Vince McMahon's call. That's why people like Randy Savage are not in the Hall of Fame, and other people are in the Hall of Fame, perhaps who don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. But anyway, it's hard to argue that Edge doesn't deserve to be in there. I mean, if this were a real Hall of Fame, he certainly has the credentials. Multiple-time world champion. In fact, he's held virtually every title there is to hold. Winner of the 2001 King of the Ring, winner of the 2010 Royal Rumble, WrestleMania headliner, carried an entire brand, that being the SmackDown brand, on his back for years. He was a proven draw, one of the best heels in the business probably in the last 10 years. On top of all that, he grew up a real fan like you and I. And, I mean, really, who can't get behind that? I mean, when you have a real wrestling fan as a kid who grows up to be, you know, one of the best in the business, come on. I mean, it's a great story. So, this week's Sound Off salute goes to Edge. Congratulations on a well-deserved honor. Also headed into the Hall of Fame as a unit are the Four Horsemen. Not the original Four Horsemen with Ole Anderson and most definitely not the version including Chris Benoit, but the third incarnation of the group. That was Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, Barry Windham, and James J. Dillon. And you know you're a legend in the case of Ric Flair when you get inducted into the Hall of Fame twice. He does become the first person to ever be inducted twice into the Hall of Fame. And I wonder if that means he'll get a second Hall of Fame ring, because if he does, he might keep the first one and pawn the second one. It would not shock me if he did that. Or maybe he would give it back to Abyss or something like that. I guess the big question all week is TNA going to allow Ric Flair to not only attend the Hall of Fame, because he attended last year's ceremony with Shawn Michaels. You know, he'll attend if he wants to attend, but will Dixie Carter allow Ric Flair to appear on stage and possibly on WWE television while under contract with TNA? You know, Flair did, he didn't do an interview, but Flair was caught on tape this week basically saying he's going to be on stage in Miami. But, I mean, that remains to be seen. You know, to me, this is not the same as Mick Foley going to TNA, if you'll recall, and asking if he could appear on Raw in a segment with The Rock. In that case, yes, I could see TNA saying, fuck you and your flannel shirt. But in this case, it's not for an angle, it's for an honor. You know, and to have the rest of the group up there and not have Ric Flair join them would be a huge mistake, especially after Flair was plastered all over that video on Monday, and they included him in the induction graphic. He almost has to be there. You know, Arn and Tully certainly deserve to be in there, as does Barry Windham, who once upon a time was probably the best natural performer in the business. You know, you'll remember when Shelton Benjamin was still in WWE, one of the things that people would say about him, this guy is the best pure athlete on the entire roster. And Benjamin never did go on to, I think, the type of greatness he could have attained. But he certainly was a hell of an athlete. Barry Windham, in many ways, was that way in his generation as well. Had a lot of great matches with Ric Flair, among others. And, you know, I guess we'll see whether Windham is even able to attend, given his recent health woes. He's doing a lot better. He still has a long road of recovery ahead of him after suffering a heart attack and a stroke recently. I know WWE is paying for all of his medical bills, which, you know, they certainly don't have to, given that he wasn't under contract with them when he fell ill. I believe that was a Triple H call. But Flair has said that this was his favorite version of the Horseman. So Ric Flair's favorite version of the Horseman is, in fact, going into the Hall of Fame. And while on the subject of the Hall of Fame, quick spoiler alert here, if you don't want to know another potential inductee this year, another name rumored to be inducted. And I don't know if this is going to be announced on Raw this Monday or in a couple of weeks, but former two-time WWF champion Yokozuna apparently on his way into the Hall of Fame. I'm going to reserve further comment until it's officially announced, but if he gets in, I will be very happy. In my opinion, he is one of the more underrated champions in WWE history, and he deserves recognition for that. So I hope he gets in, and when he does, I'll have some more to say about Yokozuna, but I wanted to throw that out there. Some more good from Raw this week. Daniel Bryan beat Kofi Kingston in a match that maybe went a minute, if that, before Bryan caught him coming off the top, put him in the lapel lock for the submission. They needed to give these guys more time. I mean, putting Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston in the ring for 60 seconds is just a fucking atrocity, considering what these two guys could probably do in the ring. It was just completely ridiculous. But this is great, I think, because unlike last week, where Bryan, the world heavyweight champion, mind you, had to beat Cody Rhodes with a small package, here, he beat Kofi Kingston decisively by forcing him to tap out. Great! He's the world champion. He should be forcing people to tap out, especially people like Kofi Kingston. No offense to Kofi. The post-match promo with Big Show played very nicely into the ongoing storyline, set up their rematch for SmackDown on Friday for the title, so I had no problem with it. By the way, I thought that was another very clever finish. I could see where if they keep doing these fuck finishes and these Big Show Daniel Bryan matches, it may start to get on my nerves. But I see the story. It's like I see the story unfolding in front of my eyes. It almost feels like these stories on SmackDown are so much easier to follow than Raw. You ever notice that? And I like this story. I mean, if you don't like this storyline, you probably hated this. I mean, having a championship match that's supposedly no DQ ending without a decision is a pretty fucking stupid way for it to end, I will admit. But I thought AJ took a hell of a bump getting knocked over by Big Show on the outside. And I liked it. So anyway, I thought this was good stuff. Then came the debut of Brodus Clay. Now, they've been teasing his return for months, and it just kept getting pushed back and pushed back and pushed back on TV by Johnny Ace. The reason being that Laryngitis wanted Brodus to get angry so that he would be a wrecking machine upon his return to Raw. Yep. Wrecking machine. You'll recall there was a plan for Clay to return on Raw after Survivor Series and destroy John Morrison on his way out, but that plan got changed at the last minute. Brodus went on Twitter. He kind of spoiled it in advance, got in the doghouse, and that spot went to The Miz instead. So we know that at one point they did have this monster return plan for Brodus Clay. Obviously, plans changed. They announced him on the show as hailing from Planet Funk, which may reside a few miles outside of parts unknown, I don't know. They refer to him as the Funkasaurus. I don't remember Spielberg using that species in Jurassic Park. Perhaps he will in his fourth movie when that eventually comes out. Then came the return of the Funkettes. They were not the same Funkettes that used to flank Flash Funk, say that five times fast, when he would come to the ring back in the day, but they looked exactly the same. I mean, if you didn't tell me who they were, I would have no idea. One of them was Naomi, who was on a season of NXT. I think she actually won. Or maybe she didn't. I don't remember. But the other Funkette was one of the people from Tough Enough. In fact, it was the first girl, in fact, eliminated from the show when Steve Austin asked her what her favorite match was of all time. And her answer was Melina versus Alicia Fox. So she makes it to the roster before, I think, anybody else from Tough Enough. I mean, Big Andy was on, what, one, two shows, and we haven't heard about him. You know, Luke never got signed. Martin, who I thought had potential and got hurt, he never got signed. But they signed Eva Lise to a contract, and now this girl's on Raw. That just lets you know WWE's priorities right there. And then Big Brodus came out to the ring to Ernest the Cat Miller's old Somebody Call My Mama music. He comes out as the Big Bad Disco Dynamo. I just made that up, by the way. That was me. I take credit for that name. When I was putting my notes together the other day, it came to me, and I jotted it down. So if I refer to him as the Big Bad Disco Dynamo from now on, you can give me credit for that. He was wearing a gigantic smile and a red jumpsuit with a top hat, looking like a mix between Flash Funk and The Godfather, and acting like a cross between Dusty Rhodes and Rikishi. That's quite a combination there. Two other men, by the way, Dusty and Rikishi, who were saddled with bad gimmicks, and they made them work. And that may be the only reason why I like this so much. I love this segment. You know, yes, this could be a career killer, or it could be the best thing to happen to his career. I mean, think about it. We have Mark Henry already on SmackDown, and Kane on Raw, as our resident monster heels. Never in my wildest dreams, no matter how much acid I had dropped, would I have come up with this gimmick for Brodus, but this was entertaining as all hell. I don't care what anybody says. This could actually work. WWE had a house show on Friday night in Yakima, Washington, and the reports from that show said that Brodus was one of the most over guys on the entire show. People were going nuts for this guy. I mean, think about it. Rikishi made his gimmick work. People love the dancing gimmick. They love the dancing fat guy. One of the all-time great Royal Rumble moments came back in 2000 when Rikishi and Too Cool just started dancing right in the middle of the Rumble match. And it's kind of funny because I remember watching that pay-per-view, and when they started dancing in the middle of the Rumble back in 2000, I hated it. I thought, this is not what the Royal Rumble is all about. The Royal Rumble is supposed to be serious. They're making a mockery out of it. Years later, I'm able to look back on it and say, you know what? That was actually kind of clever. And the fans were totally into it. And what did Rikishi do after he danced with them? He dumped him. He dumped Grandmaster Sexay and Scotty Too Hotty out of the ring. And that's the key. I mean, if they can strike that balance where Brodus is this big, fun-loving guy, but when you poke him with a stick, he'll bite your hand off and leave you with nothing but a stub, then I think the fans will get behind him in a big way. You know, Santino is not one of those characters. He's pure comedy, and he's very good at it, but he doesn't have a serious side or a mean streak in him. We already saw some of that in Brodus' match here with Curt Hawkins. And by the way, what was up with Hawkins and that pimp cane? I mean, I think I need to get caught up on my NXT viewing, apparently. I don't know what the hell that was all about, but you saw in this match where Hawkins slapped Brodus in the face and he reacted in a violent manner. You know, that's the key right there, striking that balance. He's not a complete joke. He's out there to have fun and dance and have a good time and get the fans into it. But when you poke him with a stick and you prod him and you piss him off, he's going to murder you. I also love Brodus calling out his spots in this match. I thought that was great. You know, when he goes, "Suplex, baby!" And he goes, "Should I get him?" And he goes, "My bad." I thought that was creative stuff. Really, really cool stuff. Yeah, I love my serious characters as much as anybody. I think we need less crappy comedy and more realism in wrestling, but that doesn't mean I want my wrestling to be completely devoid of colorful characters like this. I mean, I grew up on this shit. I only have one match to judge it on so far, but the key to this thing succeeding is how much Brodus embraces his new character. And if you judge it by this one match on Raw, he had another match on SmackDown this week that I haven't seen yet, but if you judge it by this one match, he knocked it out of the park. I mean, he looked like he was having a blast out there. And that's why I think this thing is going to be a success. He's going to go on to become a big babyface and sell a shit ton of merchandise. You know, and maybe in a few weeks, WWE will make a fool out of me for even thinking that. But I have hope here. I also like that he appeared to have lost some weight during his time away. But make no mistake, he's still a big dude. I mean, the guy's probably a legit 350 or so. You know, some people like to complain about these small guys like CM Punk and Daniel Bryan. Well, Brodus Clay is no small man. And big guys are always going to have an advantage anyway because Vince McMahon has conditioned his audience to think that there's, you know, that's what a pro wrestler should look like. He has to be this big dude, whether he's all jacked up or if he's just fat. He's got to be big. He's got to have size. And, you know, to all the people already writing the epitaph on the career of Brodus Clay, I think that's a bit premature. Just lighten up and have some fun. You know, there's plenty of other things on this show to bitch about. You can't help but watch this guy and smile. The segment was fun. It's a new character on Raw at a time when we desperately need new faces. Now, if they bring up guys like Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins, and provided they don't saddle all of them with gimmicks like this one, we're going to have ourselves a nice mix of fresh faces on TV in the next couple of months. And one other reason to like this, for those of you who perhaps were not completely sold on this segment, let us all be thankful they gave this gimmick to Brodus Clay instead of waiting for Samoa Joe's TNA contract to expire, because you know damn well this would have been his gimmick if he ever did come to WWE. CM Punk beat Jack Swagger in what had turned into a really good match up until the finish. Laryngitis came out before the match and told Punk that if he beat Swagger, he would ban him and Vicky from ringside for his title defense against Ziggler at the Royal Rumble pay-per-view event. Spectacular. He uses too many words, this man does. The finish saw Punk hit the Randy Savage elbow off the top rope. He went for the pin. Swagger got a shoulder up before the three. Unfortunately, referee Jack Doan missed this. I don't know how he did, but he did. Swagger clearly kicked out, but he counted the three anyway and called for the bell. For the record, this was a botch. This was not supposed to have some sort of elaborate storyline plot twist, although I guess they can turn it into one if they want to, but this was not the planned finish. The referee clearly fucked up. You could tell Punk had started to transition into the Anaconda Vice, and even the announcers didn't seem to have any idea what was going on. Punk was, he was none too happy about this, which, really, dude, you won the fucking match. I mean, what are you so pissed about? I mean, this was Randy Orton or old Shawn Michaels hissy fit stuff right here. I mean, it's one thing to take pride in your work. It's another to just scream that this shit is fake. I mean, pitch a fit in the back if you want to. Don't do that on television. Now, in spite of the botch and Punk's reaction to it, I actually like the finish of this match, which is why I'm putting it here. I think the botch enhanced the finish of this match. I don't think we've ever seen Punk win a match with that elbow. You know, nobody was expecting that to happen. It made things feel more unpredictable, as opposed to, you know, the ref fucking it up and then clearly ignoring his fuck-up because he has to stick to the script. You know, it told people, hey, these matches could actually end at any moment, not just when someone hits their, you know, fake wrestling finishing maneuver. So I actually liked it, a rare botch that I think actually made the match better. It's been said before, but it bears repeating, Ricardo Rodriguez is awesome. I just thought he was so great in that backstage segment with Miz and the Bellas, and his interaction in the ring with R-Truth was great also. Him hesitating to sing La Cucaracha and then really getting into it and the crowd eating it up and giving him a round of applause, I thought that was fantastic. The rest of the stuff with Truth and Miz was just, you know, it was there. But the Ricardo stuff made this an enjoyable segment. I actually liked this. Chris Jericho came out with the jacket and once again trolled the audience, pandering to the crowd just like last week, only this time he added fake tears to his act. He basically he's trolling Hulk Hogan now, and the way that Hulk used to milk the fans for all they were worth, and he would turn on the waterworks. But in this case, Jericho was so over the top with it, I was stunned, quite frankly, that the crowd didn't boo him. In fact, after refusing to speak for the second week in a row, he retreats up the aisleway. He's still doing his crying shtick, mind you. And he was still cheered by like 90% of the audience, which tells me either the WWE fans are really dumb or they're hip to his act and they just don't care because he's a big star, which is something that they've been dying for. I think it could be a little bit of both, actually. Either way, I like this. I had no problem with him staying silent. I expected it this week that he wasn't going to talk because, you know, why talk? Why not drag this out for a couple more weeks? I wish they would have done that with Kane, quite frankly, and kept him silent for a few more weeks. See, they did it with Jericho. Why couldn't they do it with Kane? Speaking of which, let's get to the bad on this show. I complimented John Cena earlier for showing a more serious, aggressive side at the start of the show. There was no happy smile when he came out. There was no comedy. Well, I take it all back. We had a backstage segment later in the show with John Cena and Zack Ryder. In hour two, Ryder is concerned that Kane is stalking him. Perhaps Kane is even going to kill and dismember him. He's very worried about this. And what is John Cena's response to this? This is one of his great friends. What is John Cena's response to this? Is he concerned for his friend? Does he offer to watch his back? Nope. He's more concerned about talking Twitter and reminding us that Zach is one of the most followed superstars on the WWE roster and how he just surpassed The Miz in terms of the number of Twitter followers that he has. What a terrible friend this man is. A heel, if I ever saw one. people keep talking about when is John Cena turning heel. He's already a heel. This segment is proof positive of this. This segment sucked. I didn't like that at all. Now, the ugly. Let's talk about the ugly here. Let me be clear. I like this show in spite of that awful final segment. In spite of the cheesy, melodramatic bullshit peppered throughout the entire show involving Zack Ryder and Kane. Okay? The opening segment on its own was fine. I thought it was a hot open to the show because it was so different than what we get every week on Raw with the talking. Or on the off chances, on the off weeks, we actually get a match. They'll start Raw with a Divas match. That doesn't work. Okay, in TNA, that might work. Because one thing I will say about TNA, their knockouts mean more than WWE's Divas do. I mean, on Impact, a couple of weeks ago, they let the women go out there in the main event. Now, I didn't see the whole match. I can't judge whether it was a great match. It doesn't matter, though. They had the balls to put the women on in the main event because they knew it would mean something. When WWE does a Divas match, it means nothing. So when they start the show with a match, and it's a Divas match, you may as well start out with a promo, because it doesn't mean shit. So I liked the opening this week. It was different. After that, this thing died a death. I mean, what a terrible piece of shit storyline this has become involving Cena and Kane. This is so much worse than the Edge and Kane stuff from SmackDown in 2010, which at least had Paul Bearer to make it mildly entertaining to the, you know, at times. This has nothing. First of all, Zack Ryder ain't going to be working in any NASCAR pit crews anytime soon. I mean, Jesus Christ, how long does it take to change a tire? I mean, even better, here's a wild idea. Fuck the tire and get the hell out of Dodge. They literally had a 20-minute head start on Kane before Kane caught Ryder and killed him. I mean, this was like that scene in the Austin Powers movie where one of Dr. Evil's henchmen sees Austin driving the steamroller, and he freezes in his tracks, and he starts screaming in terror at the top of his lungs, and they're telling him to move and get out of the way, and he has all the time in the world to move, but he just stands there in fear, and eventually the steamroller crushes him to death. Ryder may as well have shouted for Kane to come and get him. This was so stupid. So I guess he never did get his date with Eve, which makes Kane the big red cock block, if you want to look at it like that. While this is going on, there's a match in progress. Yes, that's right. One of those meaningless, annoying things that always seems to get in the way of the entertainment. It's John Cena against Dolph Ziggler, the number one contender for the WWE title. The match was nothing special. Cena saw his buddy getting killed on the Titantron. He ran off to help him. He left Dolph laying on the outside like nothing special. Cena ran back outside to the loading dock. Kane gave him the smothering claw, which sadly came 2 hours too late. I mean, what do we need Kane for if he's just going to take Cena out at the end of the show? Anyway, he smothered Cena. The show just ended. This sucked. There's nothing else to say. This sucked. But I still enjoyed the show overall. I did not let this ending ruin it for me. I liked a lot more on this show than I hated. But unfortunately, the show ended on a low note. This sucked. They just need to move on from this storyline. It makes no sense. It's not fun. It's not interesting. It's cheesy. It's stupid. Kill it and be done with it. On Wednesday of this week, my brother forwarded me a very odd photo of Triple H with some members of the New York Giants football team. I believe it was rookie safety Tyler Sash and the cornerback Prince Amukamara, who, with a name like that, this dude should be in wrestling, not football. And I thought it was odd because why would Triple H, of all people, who's not even a sports fan, be hanging out at Giants practice? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Well, on Thursday, things became a little bit clearer. According to a report originating on the website popthecrowd.com, Triple H's visit to Giants practice was because he was in town with other WWE officials finalizing a deal to bring either WrestleMania 29 or WrestleMania 30 to MetLife Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, home of the Giants and the Jets. Don't forget the Jets. Poor Jets. MetLife Stadium has already been announced as a location for the Super Bowl in 2014. The stadium can hold up to 82,000 fans, which does not include floor seating, so I guess you can probably get it up to 90,000 if you want to. And nothing's been confirmed yet. There's been a lot of rumor and innuendo, Jim Ross and people commenting on it, but not confirming anything. We can confirm, obviously, that these meetings have taken place. I think it's safe to say WrestleMania is probably coming to MetLife Stadium, if not next year for WrestleMania 29, then probably for WrestleMania 30. And if that is the case, that would appear to indicate that the Madison Square Garden tradition of going back to MSG where it all started every 10 years for WrestleMania, that tradition appears to be dead. And that makes me very sad because, you know, obviously WrestleMania has a history at the Garden. it originated there. WrestleMania 10 was there. WrestleMania 20. Everyone just assumed WrestleMania 30 would be there. But it's become a bit of a question because, you know, WrestleMania has gone to becoming exclusively a stadium show. And it's a stadium show that cities will bid on. You know, WWE wants these different cities around the country to be actively involved in pursuing WrestleMania. They want to throw all of these different things at WWE. We can offer you this. We can offer you that. They want to be courted. You know, they want to basically, it's like a big ego stroke for Vince McMahon in WWE. It's like the Olympics. You know, he wants people to want WrestleMania. And I don't know if the Giants and the people who, you know, run MetLife Stadium approached WWE or if it was the other way around. But this kind of came out of left field. You know, a lot of people just assumed that originally they were going to be in Toronto. You know, it's been a couple of years since they've been in Canada. Perhaps they would be in Toronto next year. You could put Edge in the Hall of Fame, put Trish Stratus in the Hall of Fame. And the Canadian crowds, I know they love to kind of make fun of them and it's bizarro world and all this, but I don't know why they make fun of their Canadian fans. It's always bugged me because Canadian fans are some of the best fans WWE has. You know, there's very few shows that they go to Canada for a big pay-per-view and the crowd sucks or the crowd is quiet. Usually the crowds are very alive. They're very energetic. It's just a lot of fun. I don't know why you would not want to bring WrestleMania back to Toronto at some point. Apparently that's not going to happen next year. And the rumor about WrestleMania going to Dallas is apparently not true as well. There was a media person for the Dallas Cowboys this week who commented to the Dallas Observer. And with respect to WrestleMania 29 or 30 coming to the new Cowboys Stadium, this person said that they cannot host WrestleMania for the next 2 years because of NCAA games that are taking place in the Final Four and whatnot. So they tried to make it work. It's not going to work. Dallas is off the table. If you take Toronto off the table, that would leave New Jersey and perhaps Indianapolis. You know, WrestleMania was in Indianapolis back in 1992 at the Hoosier Dome, which I don't believe is there anymore. If I remember correctly, the Hoosier Dome may have become the RCA Dome. I don't know if that building is actually there. I don't think it is. I believe their new stadium there is Lucas Oil Stadium. But in any event, that's still a rumor. It's not confirmed, but it hasn't been downplayed either. So it remains to be seen whether WrestleMania is coming to Jersey next year or in 2014. Obviously, if they do, I'm there. I'm going to be going to my first WrestleMania this year in Miami. I don't mind making a little mini vacation out of going to Miami, but I do think it's kind of funny that I waited after all these years. I booked this trip to Miami, and then comes the news that WrestleMania may be in my backyard a little bit sooner than even I thought, because I was planning on going back to Madison Square Garden. And if they don't go to the Garden, like I said, in a way, it's kind of the end of an era. You know, the old ECW Arena just had its final wrestling show this weekend. The end of an era. I feel like WrestleMania not going back to the Garden for at least another 10 years or whatever it may be, it's kind of the same thing. And, you know, whatever. I mean, I can understand why the building only fits barely 19,000 people. Why put 19,000 people in a building when you can put 70,000 people in a building? I mean, you could jack up the prices and probably make a lot more money that way, but obviously they want bigger stadiums. They want everything bigger, better, and better. So it appears that that will be happening. My concern, and I know there are football fans listening to this who would probably laugh in my face, but you have to understand something. WrestleMania has had a couple of open-air stadium shows in recent years, but, you know, WrestleMania 24, for example, they were at the Orange Bowl in Orlando, Florida. I believe it was 26, was in Phoenix. I believe that was also outdoors. WrestleMania this year, Sun Life Stadium in Miami, that is an outdoor open-air stadium. But you're talking about bringing WrestleMania to the Northeast in April, March or April. It's an open-air stadium with no roof. That's going to be something I think that people need to keep in mind if they think, oh, they're going to go to WrestleMania, it's going to be beautiful weather. Not the case. Not in the Northeast that time of year. You're going to freeze your ass off. And not to mention, you could have a snowstorm. Any number of things could happen. So that's something to keep in mind. I mean, I know they usually build a structure over the ring to protect it from rain, but this goes beyond just what happens if it rains. This goes to the question of, can you convince 60 or 70 or 80,000 WWE fans, not NFL fans, WWE fans, to pay very good money for WrestleMania seats and to sit outside when it perhaps is going to be 20 degrees or 30 degrees outside? I'm not even sure if I would do it. I'm sure I would at the end of the day, but it's a question I think that people need to think about, and it kind of makes me wonder what they're thinking, bringing WrestleMania there. But I guess we shall see. By the way, I'm actually recording this show while the Giants game is on. The Giants are on perhaps the brink of elimination as they fight the Packers here today. And I am missing this game so I can record this podcast. That shows my dedication right there. Even though I'm not much of a football fan, I still would like to watch the game. But I'm not. I'm doing the show. I'm not even checking the score, actually. I'm just going to wait until I'm done, and I will find out who won and who lost. So, anyway. I mentioned a few weeks ago, speaking of WrestleMania, that Shaquille O'Neal is possibly going to be wrestling a match at WrestleMania this year. The rumor was that he would have a match with Big Show, which would kind of reprise that very short-lived feud, as in one episode of Raw a couple of years back where Shaq was the guest host, and I think he knocked down the Big Show, and they teased that maybe they would do a match at SummerSlam that year, but they didn't. Shaq, I don't believe, was going to be allowed to do a match. He was still competing in the NBA. Well, obviously, Shaq now is retired. He is not under contract to any team in the NBA. He can pretty much do whatever he wants. And as the rumor has it, he has either struck a deal with WWE or is very close to doing so. Creative has been told to come up with ideas for him. Oh, boy. Famous last words right there. So I went on Facebook on Thursday, and I asked you guys. I said, listen, I'm sure that most of you could probably come up with ideas every bit as good, if not better, than what WWE could come up with, and maybe you can. So just for shits and giggles, I said that the top three best ideas you guys come up with to use Shaq at WrestleMania, or for Shaq as a character in WWE, whether you're being completely and totally serious or if you're just doing it to be funny, whatever the case may be, the top three I would pick, and I would mention them here on the Sound Off, and I have chosen my three. The first one here comes from Zach Barrett, who writes in, I'd have Shaq in attendance at the Elimination Chamber during or after, perhaps an in-ring segment. Big Show hits him with the WMD. Next night on Raw, Big Show gives his reason for the attack. He still feels humiliated after the events of 2009 when Shaq guest-hosted Raw. The next weeks up until WrestleMania should include the obvious talking segments, a brawl, and Shaq costing the Big Show the World Heavyweight Championship. The media would have to play a big part in this feud. I'd have the two hype up the match on Twitter or any television spot they can get. The Twitter thing in this case, I think, is key. As much as I dislike it when they throw Twitter down our throats, in this case it would actually make sense. Shaq has almost 5 million followers on Twitter, and WWE, of course, is in love with their social media, so I could see that. And even the Elimination Chamber thing, it's kind of like, I mean, that's what they did with Floyd Mayweather as well. You know, Mayweather was in the crowd at the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view. Big Show came back. He was beating up Rey Mysterio. Mayweather jumped over the barricade, gave him that awesome punch to the face that nearly broke his nose. It bloodied him up. It didn't actually break his nose. It almost did. That was an awesome, awesome angle. Shane McMahon came out to hold Big Show back. It felt real. It felt different. That was a great storyline. And they could do something very similar starting at Elimination Chamber with Shaq, play it up on Twitter, you know, build up to some sort of in-ring interview segment on Raw in March, have a pull-apart brawl. Again, very similar to what they did with Big Show and Mayweather. So in Zach's case here, he's basically you know, talking about the Mayweather-Big Show format and following that same playbook from 2009, which I think is probably a sensible thing I could see WWE doing. Zane Decker had another suggestion here, possibly do a playoff the Lawrence Taylor Bam Bam Bigelow story that started out at Royal Rumble in 1995. Maybe have Shaq mentioned you know, to be in the audience that night after the match, which I assume will be with Big Show and Daniel Bryan for the World Heavyweight Championship, although I don't think that's been officially announced yet, and it could very well be a triple threat match involving Mark Henry at the Royal Rumble. We'll have to wait and see. Big Show can lose, Zane says, and turn heel. After Shaq pats him on the back, offers him a handshake after the match, Show can slap him out of frustration, garnering instant heat and causing a scuffle in the front row. If Big Show is also entered in the Rumble later that night, Shaq can interfere and help eliminate him or distract him, allowing him to be eliminated to get back at him. And they could do a feud basically over who the best, largest athlete in the world really is. There needs to be more of an emotional investment in the feud, Zane says. Besides that, especially since Shaq is not a professional wrestler, there has to be more to it than just that. Maybe make a match between them a street fight instead to make the match itself a little more believable. I like Zane's idea that you start this out of the Royal Rumble as well. You know, that worked out pretty well. LT and Bam Bam, I mean, look, the match itself, Lawrence Taylor impressed me in that he was a little bit better than I thought he would be at WrestleMania 11, but that whole thing was a debacle. There's a reason why WrestleMania 11 is one of the all-time worst WrestleMania shows of all time. And putting Lawrence Taylor in a singles match, let alone, I mean, you know, you could always hide someone's weaknesses by putting them in some sort of tag match. You know, WrestleMania 14, they made Tyson an enforcer instead of putting him in an actual match. But they put Lawrence Taylor, who, you know, probably had no business, you know, being in the ring at that point. Not that he wasn't a great athlete, but he was already past his prime. Putting him in a singles match in your WrestleMania main event, probably not the best idea in the world. Especially to put him in there ahead of guys like Shawn Michaels on the card and Bret Hart and people like that. So the ending of that wasn't necessarily all that great. But I thought, you know, with the Rumble that year when they did the whole big shove in the front row, that got them a lot of publicity. That was really good stuff. So basically Zayn is saying try something similar with Big Show and Shaq. You know, you can, you know, Big Show loses again. He's frustrated, attacks Shaq. That's the cause of the big pull-apart brawl. And you've got this feud already pretty much set. You know, who is the largest athlete in the world? Who is the best largest athlete in the world? It's like the Battle of the Billionaires from a couple of years ago. I could see that working as well. Dustin Wilson had another idea of his own. I think this match needs to start via Twitter and Facebook, since WWE is hot on the social media stuff these days. Maybe Shaq gets on Twitter after Show loses another match to Daniel Bryan, starts bad-mouthing Big Show for losing to him again. This invokes the rage of Big Show, who then invites Shaq personally to attend a Raw taping where he is a special guest referee for a Big Show Daniel Bryan championship match. John Laurinaitis, vice president of talent relations, comes out and makes this Big Show's final shot at the title while Bryan holds on to it, setting up for Shaq to screw over the Big Show. Big Show almost wins the match. Maybe right before Shaq is going to go for the three count, Show's pyro accidentally goes off, startling Shaq and giving Bryan the opportunity to quickly pin the Big Show. Show then quickly turns on Shaq, nails him with the WMD. This sets the stage for the feud. Shaq is a face. Big Show is a heel. My only concern, I like the idea, my only concern with this is that that's basically what they tried a couple of years ago. And they tried very, very hard to make Mayweather the heel. Make Mayweather the babyface, I believe, in that storyline. What ended up happening is Big Show was basically cheered as the babyface. All the WWE fans were backing their own. They were backing the Big Show. They thought Mayweather was this outsider who probably didn't give a shit about wrestling. He had this very cocky, brash, arrogant attitude. And to be honest with you, Mayweather would have worked out a hell of a lot better as a heel. But they had Mayweather come out and put, you know, give people money, and he was trying to be a babyface, and it just didn't work. So Shaq is more likable, I think, than Floyd Mayweather is, but you run a very big risk. Big Show's been going around as the Jolly Green Giant now for many months, as opposed to back then, you know, which was worse if you think about it, because Big Show came back at the Elimination Chamber. That was his first night back in WWE in a long time. That was when he came back. He was showing off his slimmed-down waist. And the first thing he did was beat up Rey Mysterio. So you would think, wow, these people are going to really hate this guy. But again, they tried to turn him. It didn't work. So I would avoid trying to do that. Just let these guys be themselves. People are going to cheer whoever they want to. But the idea of bringing Shaq in, you know, it starts on Twitter. And, you know, Big Show invites him to come to Raw. And he's a guest referee. I like that because you can pop a very big rating. If I'm WWE and that's all they care about, you can pop a very big rating by promoting a Shaquille O'Neal appearance and the fact that he's going to be not wrestling, but he'll actually be a referee in a match. And you could probably really build up some interest that way by having him on the show do some sort of big angle before WrestleMania that does not necessarily take place on pay-per-view. You know, the other two people here suggested you do something at the Elimination Chamber, you do something at the Rumble. Dustin here is saying, you know what, let's do something on Raw where you'll have 4 or 5 million people as opposed to however many 100,000 who are going to see it on pay-per-view. I think that's a pretty good idea too. And those are the three ideas that I liked. I will throw one more in there. This came from Miguel, and Dennis also said the same thing. Shaq versus Big Show, WrestleMania in a free throw contest. I tell you what, I'm going to go with Big Show on that one. I think my money would be on Big Show in a free throw contest, but what do I know? So anyway, thank you to everybody who submitted ideas. I did go through all of them. I could not use all of them. I picked the three, what I thought were the three most coherent ones, and then that funny one at the end. So thank you all for your feedback. I may do more things like that on Facebook as well. So if you're not a Facebook friend, you might want to friend me on there. It's facebook.com/TheSolomonster. And get on there, and perhaps if we do another one of these, you can get your answer right here on the podcast. Word going around this week that the new WWE Network is being delayed until at least the fall of this year. Reason being, they simply don't have the infrastructure needed to launch by WrestleMania Day on April 1st. That was the original plan. They still have no head of the network. In fact, most executive positions have yet to be filled. Doesn't help that they only have two shows confirmed in the pipeline, that being the Legends House reality show, and apparently another daily call-in show similar to the old Livewire program, which would be hosted by Scott Stanford. I actually like Scott Stanford a lot, and I think he'd be great in that role. For those who don't know, Stanford is a legit news guy. He still serves as a sports anchor locally in New York for our NBC affiliate, much the same way that Mike Adamley, for example, continued to handle sports duties for his news station in Chicago while he worked for WWE as an announcer and then the Raw GM. It's actually really weird to see Stanford pop up on NBC here after seeing him on Zack Ryder's YouTube show acting all goofy. By the way, we do have a second wrestler confirmed for the Legends House show. In fact, we have three of them now, supposedly. I mentioned previously that Rowdy Roddy Piper would be part of the show, and now we know that apparently the Honky Tonk Man will be joining him, which makes two former Intercontinental Champions on the show. I say add two more and get Warrior and Nash on there as well. Show definitely has train wreck potential. Now, a third name bandied about. Actually, there's two more names, I should say, but I don't know that this is confirmed yet. One of them is the Iron Sheik. Now, I had heard that the Iron Sheik would, in fact, not be on the Legends House because physically he's in rough shape. I think he had ankle fusion surgery or had some sort of surgery recently and was not bedridden, but he was pretty much relegated to his home. He wasn't going out as much. And, you know, the older you get, the slower your recovery time will be for even the most basic of surgery. So I was of the impression Sheik would not be there. Apparently the Wrestling Observer had a note stating that Sheik was supposed to be on the show. So, you know, it remains to be seen. I haven't seen it mentioned in any other places. Dusty Rhodes is another name rumored to be on the WWE Legends House. I don't know that it's confirmed. It was also mentioned in the, I believe, the most recent Observer. So Sheik and Dusty are also possibilities. I don't know that they're confirmed. I believe Honky is confirmed and Piper is confirmed. And either way, I like the way this is shaping up. It has train wreck potential if I've ever seen it. I just hope that by the time this thing launches, I actually have access to the network. I may have no interest in anything other than the Legends House and just seeing how this thing works. So that's the update on the WWE Network. One other note here before we get to the mailbag questions. During the week, I retweeted something from Michelle Steele, who is an ESPN reporter. And she tweeted something along the lines of saying in 2010, the John Cena, quote, retail brand was worth about $106 million. I retweeted it because it just sounded completely ridiculous to me, and people thought I was retweeting it because it was an actual news item, you know, that had been independently verified by ESPN or some other major news outlet or organization. I retweeted it because it was completely ridiculous. This was a claim that WWE has made. And in WWE in 2010, you know, it's a publicly traded company here. Keep that in mind. This is not TNA. This is not UFC, where numbers come out. You know, when people say TNA averages 8,000 buys per pay-per-view, and the TNA fanboys go, well, they're not a publicly traded company, so how do you know that? And that is, by the way, how I envision these TNA fanboys sounding in real life. What they don't understand is that numbers still do get out. People do know, for example, that UFC had a couple of million buy pay-per-views in recent years, like the Brock Lesnar shows and all that. How do people know that? Since UFC is private, they figure it out. But WWE is a publicly traded company. Okay, they make their numbers well known. They're accessible online. In 2010, the company reported over $470 million in revenue. Okay, total revenue. And if you really take into consideration that if you believe what they say, that John Cena was worth $106 million all by himself in 2010, I don't know what the percentage is that that works out to. It probably is about like a quarter, maybe more than a quarter of a percent of their entire revenue from that year is derived from John Cena. That is just completely preposterous. I mean, that is just, it's ridiculous. It makes absolutely no sense. No one person is worth that much money to WWE. If John Cena, you know, did drugs tomorrow, got busted on a wellness violation, and then eventually got fired, it's not as though WWE would cease to exist. You know, they would lose their biggest star. They would take a hit, absolutely, especially on the merchandise. I don't care how well John Cena does in merchandise sales. Ain't no way he's meaning that much money to WWE. Now, what do they mean by the John Cena retail brand? They don't make that clear. ESPN did not make that clear. WWE does not make that clear. Perhaps they have some funny math over there in terms of how they're figuring that out. But, I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's not true. It makes no sense. I mean, maybe if they actually explained what they meant by that, but it just is completely, it's completely ridiculous. I saw it reported on PW Insider and some other, like, reputable websites, you know, reporting it as though it's actual fact. And these are publicly traded numbers here that are available for this company. You can go back and see, and it just doesn't add up. You know, it just does not add up. I think The Observer has an annual breakdown of all the numbers, and he goes into extensive detail. So, I mean, he would, you know, Meltzer would probably know best about this if you really break down the numbers, exactly what it works out to. How much does John Cena really mean to WWE? I'm sure it's in the millions. But it's not over $100 million, so I just wanted to address that. That's why I had retweeted that, because I saw that and my eyes bugged out of my head. If John Cena was worth that much money to WWE, believe me, the pay-per-views that he was on would be doing a hell of a lot better. They wouldn't have left him off the TLC pay-per-view altogether. You know, that would be like leaving Steve Austin at the peak of his popularity during the Attitude Era off a pay-per-view. Just leaving him off the pay-per-view altogether. It just would never, ever happen. Back then, for example, Austin as a draw meant more to pay-per-view buys and TV ratings than John Cena does. Now, John Cena is a ratings draw for WWE. You know, as badly as CM Punk, as badly as Zack Ryder have done, they've kind of they've gotten scared recently. They want John Cena to be in the main event segment. They want him in the 10 p.m. hour if they can get him in there. But it's not like John Cena is lighting the world on fire either in terms of TV ratings. So, again, he's not worth $106 million to the company. That's funny math right there. That makes no sense. It doesn't add up. It's bullshit, so I just wanted to address that. Time for the mailbag. You can send your questions and comments, as always, to me directly at thesolemonster@gmail.com, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You could also Facebook message me and Twitter me and all that, but the easiest, best direct way to get me, especially if you want a question possibly on the air, is by emailing me, so just keep that in mind. Question here comes from Diego, who writes in, "I'm a very big fan of your work, follower since episode 123. He says, "Today I came across a video on YouTube about this dummy named Yoshihiko in these Japanese wrestling promotions. It's so entertaining to not only watch the moves, like the Canadian Destroyer, but to see the creativity that they have abroad. What is your take on wrestling moves that have been banned? I think that it's exciting to see an intricate move once in a while on television. Also, do you think WWE should implement something like Yoshihiko on their programming? Personally, I'd love to see low-card guys like Santino wrestle a dummy for 5 minutes than to advertise or cut a promo backstage." It almost seemed like you were asking two different questions there. In terms of banned moves, I think, you know, throwing a banned move out there on TV every now and then will mean more. But if the move is banned for safety reasons, then I probably should just, you know, you're probably better off just leaving the move banned. But, you know, if you have somebody like Jerry Lawler, for example, I always thought that when he feuded with Michael Cole on TV, you know, he should have busted out a pile driver at WrestleMania. WrestleMania, of all places, if there was ever a time to take Michael Cole out, it would have been a WrestleMania with a pile driver. You know, meanwhile, they had Lawler and Cole do a dark match in Memphis a couple of weeks ago in a street fight, and Lawler gave him a pile driver. So what is it? Is it banned? Or is it not banned? If you're going to let him use the pile driver, why they didn't let him do it on TV, I'll never know. As far as Yoshihiko, people can type in Yoshihiko. It's Y-O-S-H-I-H-I-K-O, for those of you spelling impaired. You can type that in on YouTube. I've seen the Yoshihiko videos before. I think they're really entertaining. I thought it was awesome. I've also seen the match, if you look up on YouTube, between Kenny Omega and the little Japanese girl. I mean, if we've got to have lame comedy on WWE TV, or really any wrestling TV here in the U.S., I'd be in favor of replacing it with stuff like this. I mean, at least it's entertaining. It doesn't, well, I guess I can't say it doesn't insult our intelligence. But let's be honest. I mean, if you have a match with a wrestler against the dummy, people already know. They're hip to what's going on. It's still fun to watch. If you haven't seen those videos, by the way, check it out. It's worth a few minutes of your time. Natosha writes into the Sound Off. She says she just heard the question on episode 200 about the guy who could pop his shoulder out of place. I'm one of those people who can do that. When you first do it, the trick is that the more you do it, the worse it gets. At first, I guess it doesn't hurt as much, is what she's saying. After a couple of times of popping mine out and almost not being able to get it back into place without an ER visit, I stopped doing it. It can also give you arthritis in your shoulder. There are times when I can't even move my arm because my shoulder hurts so bad. I can't even imagine what that guy went through during that match with George Steele. Just wanted to give some insight into it. Yeah, she's referring to the Rick Bolton match I mentioned from the mailbag last week. I believe it might have been Valentino, or maybe it was Victor who wrote in about that. And it was one of the most uncomfortable, brutal displays in any wrestling match that I've ever seen. And this was from what I guess would be more of it was really just an enhancement match for George Steele back when he was a heel in the early days of his WWWF run in the mid to late 70s. And you can hear, you know, Vince McMahon was on commentary, and it's just absolutely brutal stuff. And some people can do that. They can, on their own, voluntarily, on the spot, pop their arm out of its socket. I mentioned Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon as an example of that, and Natosha here says she can do it as well, and the more you do it, the worse off you are. So I guess my suggestion to people out there who can do it, it's not like a superpower, okay? It's not something that I would be going around showing off to people more often than I had to. You don't need arthritis and problems like that down the road. That's no fun. But thank you to her for sharing that story. Jason writes in, can you envision a heel versus Undertaker match at WrestleMania where the heel puts his feet on the ropes and beats the Undertaker? Afterwards, the referee would rewatch on the Titantron, restart the match, and the Undertaker would beat him, and the streak goes on. I hate that idea. That is a terrible idea. It's like getting, you know, the visual pin. That's essentially what it is. You know, you're saying basically that somebody's going to get the pin on the Undertaker at WrestleMania. Shock will set in. People will not believe what they've just seen. And then the referee sees it, basically says, okay, the match is going to continue, that didn't count, and Undertaker goes on to win, but people have already seen Undertaker get pinned. It's the whole illusion, you know, you've never had a WrestleMania where somebody has gotten a visual pin on the Undertaker, not that I can recall. You know, maybe one of his early matches, they got, you know, the referee was knocked down, and somebody got the 1-2-3, but the referee didn't see it. I don't even think we've ever seen that in an Undertaker match. To do that would be one of the most cheap finishes to an Undertaker match at WrestleMania you could ever do. And I absolutely do not like that idea at all. Justin Bridge writes into the sound. I've been a listener since episode 126. I'm hoping to get a birthday shootout. What is with these people and their shootouts? I am a nonviolent person, people. I give shoutouts, not shootouts. His birthday is Wednesday, January 18th. He would be very appreciative if I can give him the shout-out. Great job on episode 200, and here's to many more. Well, thank you, Justin. Happy birthday this Wednesday. Hope you have a very enjoyable day. Sean Hamilton writes into the show. He says, I love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Sometimes it's the only thing that keeps me into wrestling. I mentioned Sean's name here because he also left me a review in iTunes, and I did say that if you leave me a review in iTunes, I'll give you a shout-out on the show. So thank you to Sean for doing that. By the way, the same offer still applies. Anybody who wants to leave some feedback on the show in iTunes, it's very easy to do. If you do that, I would be very appreciative, and I would be more than happy to give you a shout-out, but you got to write me in and let me know about it first. Kenneth writes into the Sound Off with two questions here. How much meaning did Jake the Snake Roberts' job to Austin at the King of the Ring mean to Steve Austin's career? Was it treated as a big deal, aside from the Austin 316 promo that followed? No, not really. Not at all. I don't think that Jake's job to Austin meant anything, really. Everything was about the promo that came after the match. Now, Austin owes Jake a lot of thanks because Jake's character when he came back, and I shouldn't even say character. I mean, Jake had been, he turned over a new leaf on his life. And he had become a born-again Christian, which sadly did not do him much good. Of course, the demons did come back eventually. But in 1996, Jake's character that he portrayed on TV was that of a new Jake the Snake Roberts, somebody who had found religion, was a changed man. I think his new snake was called Revelations. And, you know, he was the underdog in the King of the Ring tournament. People wanted him to win, and he went all the way to the finals. He had the busted-up ribs after being attacked by Vader earlier on at the pay-per-view. And he was already an injured, old, crippled man by the time the finals came. Austin beat him, as he should have. The match itself was nothing special. In fact, the match pretty much sucked. Because Jake at that point, even without selling the injured ribs, which only made the match worse, was in no condition to go out there and put on a 4-star match. I don't care how good Steve Austin is. The match itself didn't mean anything to Austin's career. It was what came after the match, but he owes a debt of thanks to Jake because of the character. You know, he knew of the religious kind of overtones of Jake's character, of his persona. He used that creatively in his promo. That's where Austin 316 came from. If it was just Jake the Snake Roberts, you know, the wrestler as he was years ago, we never would have gotten Austin 316. Now, would Austin have gone on to become a big star and a champion? I think he would have, because, again, he was too good not to be. But who knows when that would have happened. I mean, then again, you know, the Austin 316 promo came in June of 1996, and at SummerSlam 2 months later, he was, you know, in a match with Yokozuna on the free-for-all pre-show. He didn't even make it onto the pay-per-view. Austin really didn't start to hit it big until, you know, the middle part of 1997, a year later. Well after the WrestleMania match with Bret Hart. So, you know, you can even argue the Austin 316 thing, how much did that really mean to Austin's career? It certainly meant a lot to his merchandise numbers. But the match with Jake the Snake was nothing special. The match itself didn't mean anything. Second question here from Kenneth. Did Jim Ross really think Austin got to Mike Tyson? And that it was him getting his ass kicked and not some random security guy, the way JR was calling that whole moment on Raw back in 98. I believe he thought Austin was actually getting to Mike Tyson. No, that was just Jim Ross being really fucking good at his job. Stuart Brody writes in, unfortunately, I missed saying this before the Landmark show, but a real heartfelt congratulations on making it 200 shows. I really do appreciate you doing the shows. It's one of the highlights of my week. Plus, it's really helped me in situations in my life. This might sound cheesy, but if I am in an awkward situation, I listen to the show, and it does give me comfort. It also, strangely, helps me get over hangovers. Well, there you go. There's a new remedy for you. Again, this is probably the most uncool email you've ever gotten, but I wanted to write this to tell you all your hours of making this show do not go unappreciated. I hope it continues to reach landmarks for years to come, and I do appreciate that a lot. Stuart, I think, has been one of our longtime listeners, and I appreciate that, but he does have a question here. In 30 years' time, which superstar do you think WWE history books will look on the kindest? Shawn Michaels, arguably the greatest wrestler in the history of WWE, Stone Cold, the most popular WWE superstar of all time, or The Undertaker, the wrestler with the most longevity in WWE. And I would argue, by the way, probably the most respect. Honestly, I think that WWE history books, unless, God forbid, there's a Benoit-type situation between now and then with one of these guys, and they do something really stupid, or they take their own life, I think the history books will look back very kindly on all three. If I had to pick one over the others, which one will the history books look on the kindest? I'd have to go with The Undertaker. And not just because he's been with the company the longest, but if you look at it, Shawn Michaels in the first part of his career made a lot of enemies. There were not very many people out there who liked Shawn Michaels. And he'll admit to you himself, he was a dick. He was one of the biggest dicks in the wrestling business. And when he came back after the layoff, he was a completely changed person for the most part. I mean, there were still people who probably didn't like him. You know, we know Hurricane Helms, for example, had some not so nice things to say about Shawn a few years back. But, you know, Shawn did have that period in his career where he made a lot of enemies, didn't treat people very nicely, and he made life very difficult for Vince McMahon, for Jim Ross, for a lot of the people who worked in WWE. You can't ignore that. Steve Austin walked out on the company. Steve Austin would openly voice his displeasure with the creative process and with things that were going on. You think back to 2002, again, he walked out on the company, didn't want to do the job to Brock Lesnar, which I agree with Steve Austin. I'm not saying he was wrong in that situation. But again, you can point to situations where there was angst between Austin and WWE. There were problems behind the scenes. With The Undertaker, you never had any of that. You never hear stories of Undertaker, you know, butting heads with the WWE management, Undertaker walking out of the company. People think that Undertaker's a real dick or he's holding talent down. I mean, there are people who claim that Undertaker has held talent down. I've never seen evidence of this. I've never had wrestlers or seen interviews with wrestlers after leaving WWE who said, wow, you know, The Undertaker was a real asshole and he plays the political game. He held me down, this and that. I mean, the one thing I will say, there was something, for some reason, Undertaker did not like Diamond Dallas Page. And I don't know what it is. I don't know that DDP has ever commented on it. The way that DDP was booked during that whole stalker angle after the invasion started in 01 and he came over to WWE, he was not booked strongly at all. In fact, their fight, quote-unquote, that DDP and Undertaker had at the King of the Ring, DDP was made to look like a complete joke. That was by design. There was some, I don't know if it was animosity, if Undertaker just didn't respect him, whatever the deal was. That would be the closest thing I could think of. Undertaker is about as respected a star on the WWE roster as you will ever find, including the other two people you mentioned, Steve Austin and Shawn Michaels. They both respect the hell out of The Undertaker. I think the history books will look back the most kindly on him. Khan writes into the podcast. I figured I should probably answer his question. I certainly don't want to incur the wrath of Khan. Now that the Four Horsemen are inducted into the Hall of Fame, would you like to see more stables get inducted like the NWO and DX? No, I don't, actually. I am not a fan of putting stables and gimmicks in the Hall of Fame. The Horsemen, you know, they're inducting them. There's nothing that could be done. They made the announcement. And if anybody deserves to go into the Hall of Fame twice, it is Ric Flair for all of his faults. You will never find a more complete, true professional wrestler who had as many good matches and is as respected by as many people as Flair was, especially in the prime of his career. You know, and you could say, oh, maybe Shawn Michaels deserves to go in twice or Hulk Hogan, you know, in the WWE Hall of Fame, but you know, NWO in the Hall of Fame, DX, where does it end? You want to put the Nation in there, huh? You want to put the Truth Commission, the Oddities? You know, do we really need to see Shawn Michaels go in twice and Triple H go in twice and Hulk Hogan go in twice and Kevin Nash possibly go in twice? We don't need to see that. Lewis wrote into the Sound Off as well with the similar, in fact, I think it was the same exact question about stables in the Hall of Fame, so you know my answer on that, but he also wanted to know if he can get a shout-out. His new son was born Wednesday, January 4th. His name is Jace. So big congratulations there to Lewis on the birth of his new son. He says he loves the show. Thank you for making my Mondays easier with the Sound Off. Monday is the shittiest day of the week, even with Raw, and let's be honest, most weeks Raw just makes it even more a pile of shit. So if I can do anything on my part to make your Mondays easier to tolerate, then I'm all for it. Last email here comes from Mickey Roman, another longtime listener of the show here, dear Solemn Monster, huge fan since the very first Sound Off, in fact. Was watching Raw, and I couldn't help but notice with short hair, Chris Jericho looks kind of like a buff Neil Patrick Harris. Well, I've never noticed that. I was also hoping to get a birthday shout-out on the next show, since my birthday is this Tuesday, but I was hoping instead of me, my girlfriend Laura should get my shout-out instead, because she's the best girlfriend in the world for surprising me today with a ticket for WrestleMania 28 as my birthday gift. That is a badass girlfriend right there. So, a shout-out to Laura for getting Mickey his WrestleMania ticket. That is a really cool gift right there. And who knows, perhaps you and I will bump into each other in Sun Life Stadium. I mean, come on. What are the chances you and I won't bump into each other among 75,000 other people? I mean, come on. If you've got questions for the Sound Off, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. I have a whole stack of questions here I couldn't get to, some questions on a whole bunch of different stuff, including Ring of Honor, which I haven't talked about much lately. I'm going to try to get to those questions off-air and maybe save some of them for the next show. And you can keep sending me in your questions. Follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/Solemonster is the place to follow me. And friend me on Facebook. Facebook.com/TheSolemonster. We have a lively discussion thread going every Monday night during Raw. And we could also possibly have more threads on there if I ask you guys to submit ideas or answers to this or that. And perhaps you could even get on the show that way. Get on Facebook. You got to friend me on there, facebook.com/TheSolemonster. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes just by typing in the name. And you can subscribe to my YouTube channel. It is my username on there is TheSolemonster. No spaces, no dashes, no underscores. All one word. And if you do all that, you will in fact be part of the Fantastic Four. Not the Triple Threat, not Double Trouble. It is indeed the Fantastic Four. I appreciate all your support. As always, we're going to be doing another Match Anatomy soon as well. I've got a whole bunch of ideas for you guys for episode 202 onward. Onward and upward with more Sound Offs here in 2012. That's what I say. I'm also thinking about doing a review of the 1991 Royal Rumble pay-per-view, which is currently in the rotation on WWE Classics. Not just the Rumble match, the entire Rumble pay-per-view. Maybe I'll do a Match Anatomy dedicated to that if I could find the time to watch the pay-per-view perhaps sometime this weekend, so we'll see about that. Until next time, be well, stay safe. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show. Keep spreading the good word, letting other people know about it as we expand our audience. Episode 202, on tap for next weekend. Until then, make it a good one, guys.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemn Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.